I don't remember Rendezvous Park, but you do remember it.
No, yeah, Rendezvous Park was a great place.
You saw the A's play there.
Reggie Jackson, Roland Fingers, Catfish Hunter.
So, and there they were at Rendezvous Park.
I mean, if you were to look at it now, you would say, what a dump. Your professional teams darkened this rickety stadium. I think I still have splinters in my rear end from the seats at this stadium.
You are an injury lawyer. I think you could probably bring suit against the city. That might get a little strange.
Yeah, well, it was a permanent injury, no question.
It's always cool in Mesa.
Yes, it is.
It's always cool in Mesa.
Yeah.
Forget the degrees and just remember this, please. I say it's always cool in Mesa.
Mesa is known for many things, but for a lot of people across our country, Mesa is synonymous with one thing, spring training. Every February and March, Mesa hosts both the Chicago Cubs at Sloan Park and the Oakland A's at Hohokam Park. You might think that's just always how it's been. But the story of how once sleepy Mesa became the epicenter of the Cactus League will surprise you. It's Always Cool in Mesa, Season 4, Episode 2. Spring Training and the Father of the Cactus League.
It's always cool in Mesa.
Discover the ultimate Mesa experience and explore the Sheraton Mesa Hotel and Courtyard Mesa Hotel at Wrigleyville West. Dine in style and indulge in a culinary journey with three dining options spread across these two properties. From bistro bites to all-American food, they have something for every palate. Unmatched event space with over 30,000 square feet of indoor and outdoor meeting spaces. They're the perfect venue for conferences, weddings, corporate events, and more. They'll make your event unforgettable. Their prime location off the 101 and 202, adjacent to the Cubs Spring Training Stadium, is nestled inside Mesa's Riverview Park. Come see the best Mesa has to offer for yourself. A note before we begin. You'll hear in this episode the story of how Dwight Patterson started a service organization named after the industrious people who lived here long ago. The Hohokams. That's how it's been pronounced in recent decades, and still is by most Valley residents today. In this episode, you'll hear it pronounced that way by several people, including myself, but it's incorrect. The Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community is currently trying to reclaim the correct pronunciation of a word that means the departed ones, the Hoohoogum. We beg their patience in our journey to better honor the memory of the first builders of this land.
Continue here on ESPN tonight. From the desert, the New York Mets take on the Arizona Diamondbacks from the Bank One ballpark, commonly known as the Bob.
It was 1999. In only their second year of existence, Jerry Colangelo's Arizona Diamondbacks had made the playoffs, faster than any expansion team in baseball history. The stadium was sold out and buzzing with energy. But before Arizona's ace, Randy Johnson, could take the mound, someone would need to throw out the ceremonial first pitch. Colangelo knew he'd found the right person. An 87-year-old man walked onto the field.
Throwing out tonight's ceremonial first pitch is one of Arizona's baseball pioneers. He helped bring the Chicago Cubs to Arizona for spring training in 1952. The success of the Cubs led to the full development of spring training in the Grand Canyon State. Ladies and gentlemen, the Arizona Diamondbacks ask you to join us in welcoming Dwight Patterson.
Dwight Patterson. Friends called him Pat. I spoke with his daughter, Ann Patterson Cleghorn, about why her father was chosen for that honor.
Jerry Colangelo said, I rode into Phoenix on the shoulders of Dwight Patterson.
I rode into Phoenix on the shoulders of Dwight Patterson. Jerry Colangelo knew what Pat had done for baseball in Arizona. In fact, there was hardly a professional organization in the Valley that didn't owe a debt to Pat. And I'm so proud to tell you, Dwight Pat Patterson was a Mesa man through and through. But his life started in Tempe in 1912. Later, he went to school in Glendale. Even as a young man, Pat had one driving passion.
He loved sports. Everything was sports.
After being a standout athlete at Peoria High, Pat set his sights on becoming a coach. He went to Arizona State Teachers College in Flagstaff, now NAU, then returned to his alma mater to become the football team's assistant coach. But then, a plot twist.
Well, then he met Mother. The story goes, and he says it's true, that she walked into the lunchroom, and he turned to one of his buddies and said, I'm marrying her.
Her name was Ruby Mae Dobson, and Ruby was a Mesa girl. Her father, John Dobson, owned thousands of acres surrounding the family home at the corner of two dirt roads in the middle of nowhere, Alma School and Baseline. He had married well, it's true, but Pat's new life as a farmer was far from pampered.
He had the old workhorses and plowing and all. That's right. How he started out. It was tough here.
When Pat's brother-in-law, Cliff Dobson, took ill, Pat helped run his neighboring ranch. In time, they started the Baseline Cattle Company and the Sheep Springs Sheep Company. The aspiring coach had become a rancher, and a successful one at that. By the time World War II was over, Pat was a man of influence in Mesa. He became a leading member of the Mesa JCs, or Junior Chamber of Commerce. And when it came to commerce, Pat had strong opinions.
He was so positive that Mesa had such a draw for tourists. That was his first love, these tourists. They used to take tours out to the desert. These Easterners just ate it up, just loved all of that. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we had the ranches, the feedlots, so they'd take them out there, too, and then they'd see them shear sheep.
Pat was into agritourism before agritourism was cool. But why the Dude Ranch side hustle?
He just had this whole thing about the tourist season. So I guess it's because he was paying attention to Florida and seeing how much money they were getting in, and it just kind of bugged him.
It bugged him because the main feature of their tourist season was something Mesa could do better.
Yes, the famous names in baseball enjoy their spring training as they limber up their muscles in St. Petersburg sunshine. Whether you're a big league baseball player or just a fan who likes to watch the big boys in action, you'll find that a cordial welcome awaits you when you come to St. Petersburg.
In Pat's mind, professional baseball players could limber up in Mesa just as easily as they could in St. Petersburg. And yet Florida had 10 of the 16 major league teams in what they called the Grapefruit League. Arizona only had two, with none in Mesa. Pat was determined to get the JCs to fix that. There were just two problems. The JCs weren't sold on Dwight's baseball dreams. But even if they were, Pat had just turned 35, and according to one former JC, that meant you were, quote, an exhausted rooster. Having aged out of the JCs, Pat, along with 34 other men, started a special events committee called the Ho-Ho Camps, named after the industrious ancients who gave us our canal system. Their main purpose would be to support spring training in Mesa. If it sounds like the concept of spring training was novel in 1947, it wasn't. The first spring training happened 155 years ago when the infamous Boss Tweed sent his New York Mutuals south to New Orleans to get ready for the season in 1869. I spoke with Dilworth Britton Jr., self-proclaimed second best local historian. His father, Dilworth Sr., was one of the original Ho-Ho-Cums. Dilworth Jr. says spring training has a long history in Arizona and Mesa as well.
Professional clubs, since they were back east, they would come out west and barnstorm a little bit during the year. And the Chicago White Sox came through Yuma back in 1904. And then there were several other clubs that came in 1909 and then in 1913 and 1914. Mm-hmm. And they found out, hey, we can stop in Mesa and the people will pay money to watch us play baseball.
I don't know who the first best local historian is, but it's hard to imagine they know more than Dill. Back to baseball. In 1914, the city pulled together a few hundred dollars and the barnstorming White Sox agreed to stop and play the town's best minor league team, the Mesa Jewels. News spread like wildfire. On the appointed day, there was a parade. Trains brought people in from all over Arizona. The city declared a holiday, and Governor George Hunt threw out the first pitch. The Jewels lost 15-2, but no one cared. The big leaguers had come to town and did it again in 1915 and 16. Mesa had baseball fever. In 1920, the city built Rendezvous Stadium at 2nd Street in Surine.
So people have been watching professional baseball teams, including the Chicago White Sox in Mesa.
100 years.
100 years, people. In 1929, Phoenix hosted its first spring training game when Mickey Cochrane, Charlie Gehringer, and the rest of the Detroit Tigers rolled into town to play the Pittsburgh Pirates. Among the crowd was a strapping 17-year-old baseball player from Peoria High, young Dwight Patterson. Whether that event was the seed of his future plans, we'll never know. But we do know that by 1950, Pat had convinced the Oakland Oaks, a minor league team, to give Rendezvous Stadium a try. It failed. But Pat was eager to try again with a professional team.
The city had lost money in 1950 and 1951, and they were not interested in putting up more money for baseball.
And yet, in 1952, Pat lured none other than the world-famous Chicago Cubs to make Rendezvous Park their spring training home.
How did your dad land, you know, Major League Baseball team in Mesa, Arizona in 1951?
Well, he knew Stoneham, Horace Stoneham.
Horace Stoneham was the owner of the New York Giants, one of the two teams that already held spring training in Arizona.
And he introduced him to Mr. Wrigley.
That's William Wrigley Jr., chewing gum magnate and owner of the Chicago Cubs.
Mr. Wrigley was training in Catalina Island, and they didn't like the weather.
Plus, there was no one else to play. I mean, they were literally on an island. So Mr. Wrigley invited Pat to his mansion on Camelback Mountain. His pitch must have been persuasive.
Mr. Wrigley was impressed. He sent his staff over to look at Rendezvous. They fell in love with Mesa because they said there's no nightlife. The players aren't really going to have trouble keeping the players in. So they just thought Mesa was delightful.
So if I heard this right, the Cubs signed on with Mesa because it had great weather, nearby competitors, a nice stadium, and, I can say this because it's no longer true, it was downright boring. Whatever it takes. The bottom line is from that time to this, except for one year in the 60s, Mesa has had the excitement, the prestige, and the revenue that comes from Major League spring training. But it may have never happened without Dwight Pat Patterson.
He just hit it off with all the baseball people. He just was kind of a natural.
One of Pat's ho-ho cams shared a memory with Ann.
When they would go to the winter meetings, they said that it was like Dwight held court in the lobby of the hotel. Every team, every manager come, hi, Pat, hi, Pat.
By all accounts, Pat was as comfortable around baseball's glitterati as he was his sheep and cattle. Ann remembers getting the benefits of her dad's new social circles.
With Mr. Wrigley, they invited Mother and Dad and I over for dinner at the mansion. And I was probably about 12 at this point. And we had maids and butlers waiting on us.
And years later,
one of the parties, Joe DiMaggio, was there. So, you know, my girlfriend and I.
That's one of the biggest names on the planet at the time, wasn't
it? Yes, right, yes. Dad warned us, okay, now don't be talking to him too long, and don't ask for an autograph, and don't ask him about Marilyn. And
that's Joe DiMaggio's girlfriend, one Marilyn Monroe. There was one more reason Pat was able to help Mesa secure the Cubs.
He's the one that signed the contract with the Cubs. Mm-hmm. Wasn't with the city or the Chamber of Commerce.
Dwight guaranteed the contract, then set the ho-ho cams to work.
So when Dwight was getting the Cubs situated here, obviously he needed volunteers to take the tickets and sell the concessions.
And repair the ballpark. They would put the fence up. They would paint it, okay. Put the numbers and the stencil on the seats. I used to go as a young kid with my dad and as a five-year-old to sell programs and a pencil for a quarter.
And so that is the same organization that you're a member of today, mm-hmm. and that mm-hmm. The people would recognize the bolo ties and the
shirt. Red shirt.
The ho-ho cams of yesteryear did whatever it took to make spring training succeed, and they're still at it today, almost 75 years later. There's a lot to do, like greeting fans when they arrive.
Hi there. Great day for a ball game.
Sure is.
Yes. You're going to go around the circle and park off that way in the yellow line.
helping them get parked.
Keep coming. Keep coming. Car coming in right next to you. Enjoy the game.
Taking their ticket at the gate.
You're good to go. Thank you. Hi there.
And like Ho-Ho Cam Debbie Isley, helping them find their seat. I asked Debbie, what's the best part of being an usher?
Well, we have season ticket holders that sit in my row, and they run up every year, Debbie, and hugs, and they draw me pictures for my refrigerator.
Side benefit, Debbie has developed a solid stadium whistle over the years. The Ho-Ho Cams are the envy of every spring training stadium. Once Mesa got the Cubs in 52, Pat was determined to make sure they stayed got.
There were times that he would get a call from Wrigley back in Chicago. We need this and that. Dwight would pull out a cocktail napkin and write down what they needed. Okay, we need a batting cage. We need a, you know, this. And Dwight would then take care of it and make sure that it was there.
Ann remembers another such occasion.
The Cubs were wanting a new dressing area. So the Ho-Ho said, no, we're not voting for it. So
Pat made it happen anyhow.
And the Ho-Hos were not happy with him.
Yeah.
They thought he'd overstepped.
Seems like your dad was a strong leader.
Very strong person.
And so I don't think he made decisions based on what a committee told him to do.
Because he wanted to keep the Cubs.
On another occasion, on the eve of an important game, a storm made the field unplayable. Pat couldn't stand the idea of canceling, for the sake of the game, the fans, and the lost revenue.
Dwight hired a helicopter to come and hover over the field to cause the air to be forced down on the field to try and dry it out.
Ann said it actually worked, and the game went on.
The game went on. Didn't lose any money on that one.
The spring of 52 was a huge success in Mesa, as was 53. In 1954, a fourth team, the Orioles, began training in Yuma. The Cactus League had truly taken root. It was clear to people then, as it was to Jerry Colangelo almost 50 years later, that this was primarily the handiwork of Dwight Pat Patterson, the father of the Cactus League. But Pat wasn't done.
He tried to get all as many teams here as he possibly could, and he lived long enough to see it.
Like the guy who gets picked off at first, Florida got caught sleeping.
Florida didn't think much of Arizona. You know, they're out west. Don't worry about them. But once we got 8 or 10 teams out here and we started doing well, then all of a sudden, wait a minute, we want to get all this over in Florida.
Right.
And so some of the cities would build baseball stadiums with no team, and then they would come out and shop their stadium to see if they could get them to move.
Pat was basically in a turf war.
He just wanted to make sure that Florida didn't have more teams than we did. And if one was going to leave from here, he'd break anybody's bone to keep them here.
I'm sure that was just a colorful metaphor. Pat was the father of the Cactus League, not the godfather. Today, the Cactus League and the Grapefruit League each host 15 teams for spring training. And Mesa is the only city in the Valley to host two teams in two separate stadiums. All accomplished without breaking a single bone, I'm sure. But there were hundreds of twists and turns along the way. The Cubs left in 65, only to return in 77. The A's came and went and returned again. Stadiums fell and rose. But the one constant was always Pat, quietly doing the business of baseball in Mesa.
He was a person who was behind the scenes. He didn't want publicity. He really, and he truly didn't. They mentioned naming the first park after him. He got steamed, but they went ahead and did it anyway.
Pat's generosity and community spirit wasn't confined to just baseball. He thought everyone should have access to a great education. 10 years on the Mesa School Board, president of the Arizona School Board Association, 3 5-year terms on the Maricopa Junior College Board, the Arizona Board of Regents.
If there was a board out there, his name was on it. The list was just incredible. He was very generous, and I heard stories about him helping families after he passed away. People have come to me and tell me that mother and I never knew.
The charitable stuff that he did, as my dad says, Dwight gave the purest service of anyone.
Today, just as back then, the Hohokams reflect Pat's spirit of service. And it's always about providing opportunity for young people. As a Hohokam, Anita Peters is able to provide much-needed funds to a local Little League.
They use it for whatever they need. If a kid doesn't have shoes, they can buy him shoes. If he doesn't have a mitt, they can buy him a mitt. So I'm really proud of that.
She also volunteers at an annual swim and dive competition. They provide new branded beach towels and a barbecue for the kids. She knows they appreciate it.
They're just always walking around. Just every time they see one of us, they thank us. It's really heartwarming.
There was one last dramatic turn in Mesa's spring training story. In 2008, Mesa was hit by a perfect storm. It was the Great Recession, the Cubs were sold to a new owner, and lastly, the new owners were deeply connected to Florida. Scott Smith, Mesa's mayor at the time, remembers the moment well.
There was a lot of movement in Naples to lure the Cubs from Mesa, so I knew this was serious. This was not just an idle threat. This was the real deal.
The Cubs had also become concerned that Mesa's Hohokam Park, which had been knocked down and rebuilt for the Cubs just 20 years earlier, no longer met their needs. And what was Naples offering? A brand new state-of-the-art stadium. The new owners, the Tribune Company, owned by the Ricketts family, made it clear that they were open to staying if Mesa could match Naples' offer.
There was only one problem. Remember, we're in the Great Recession, and we have no money.
Mm.
And so the idea is, how would we ever, ever build this?
Given the mood in Mesa at the time, Smith knew voters would never support a bond to build the stadium. They tried other options. Nothing worked. More than a year passed. Finally, a fresh idea emerged.
The city of Mesa in, I think, 1983 or 4, purchased 11,000 acres of farmland in Pinal County.
From his experience as a builder, Mayor Smith knew it might fetch the right amount. But Mesa had a particular provision in its city charter, which said
that if the city were to spend more than $1.5 million on any concert hall, auditorium, stadium facility, it had to be approved by the voters.
The city was pretty sure the voters would approve the sale of the land for the stadium, but the next election was 8 months away.
We went to the Cubs and we said, listen, we got a plan, but we need to go to the voters. And that's not going to happen until November.
The Cubs didn't like the sound of that. They were anxious to make their decision. Now, I can tell you from personal experience as a Mesa mayor who has studied the balance sheet on spring training, the stakes were very high. Losing the Cubs with the best traveling fans in all of baseball while wading through a recession would be a serious blow. Mayor Smith would make his case to the Cubs one last time.
I met with the Ricketts family, and the mood in the room was very, very negative. Mm. I've been in those meetings before.
Yeah.
You know, I've had girlfriends, and I know when they're going to tell you they're moving on, all right? Yeah, I've been there before.
They had that look in their eyes. You know, Scott, it's not you, it's us. We're going to Naples. Okay.
And I think they were there to let me down and saying, listen, we're just going to move on to Naples.
It had come down to this. Bottom of the ninth, two down, full count. Scott had one last swing.
And I said, I'm not going to lie to you. You're the Cubs. You're going to be successful no matter where. But listen, I don't know what 50 years, four stadiums, the type of support you've now experienced get you, but I think it should get us 8 months.
In essence, what Mayor Smith was saying was, remember our boy Pat, the man who first brought you to Mesa and scribbled out your wishes on a napkin, who marshaled an army of volunteers in your behalf, and yes, who once ordered a helicopter to dry out the diamond. That wasn't the only rainy day he showed up for. All of these things and 1,000 untold deeds should buy us 8 months. The Cubs agreed. So did the voters. When the new stadium, Sloan Park, was finished, Ann paid it a visit.
Oh, I just got tears. I felt like Dad was with me and just, like, this is the most gorgeous ballpark.
So now you know why it was Pat who walked out to the mound on that October day in 1999.
He walked out just so stiff.
Throwing out tonight's ceremonial first pitch is one of Arizona's baseball pioneers, Dwight Patterson.
But he was thrilled. He threw a good ball. And 3 days later, he was watching the team on TV at home. He was in his office, and he passed away.
Wow.
Just went to sleep. It's like he covered all the bases and went home.
Today, the Cactus League generates more than $300 million in annual revenue valley-wide. And one team keeps breaking the Cactus League record for attendance, the Chicago Cubs at Sloan Park. The next time you're at a baseball game, do me a favor, won't you? During the seventh inning stretch, take a moment and tip your hat to the father of the Cactus League, the quiet cattleman who brought baseball to Mesa. Because here in Mesa, as I often say, we stand on the shoulders of giants. One of the tallest was Dwight Pat Patterson. Thanks to our sponsors, the good people at Sheraton Mesa Hotel and Courtyard Mesa Hotel at Wrigleyville West. If you're enjoying this podcast, please like and subscribe and tell a friend.